Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
Memory can be a tricky thing. Sometimes it's hard for us to remember even things that are really important to us. You may have heard the one about the couple that was afraid. They were starting to have trouble remembering things, and so they went to the doctor, and the doctor said he didn't think it was anything serious, but he suggested maybe writing some notes. He said a lot of times people find it helpful to write notes about what they're going to do. And so as they got home later that night, they were watching TV, and the wife told her husband, "I'd really like some ice cream." And he said, "Well, I'll go in the kitchen and get you some." And she said, "Now, wait a minute, don't you need to write a note about this? Because you might get in the kitchen and forget why you were there." And he said, "That's nonsense. I will remember to get a bowl of ice cream." And she said, "Well, that's good, but I'd also like strawberries. Can you put strawberries on it?" He said, "I'll put strawberries on the ice cream." She said, "Do you need me to write a note?" She said, "No, I'll remember that." She said, "Because I also want whipped cream. I'd like an ice cream with strawberries and whipped cream." And he said, "Okay." She said, "Now, if you want, I can write down a note." He said, "I can remember that you want ice cream, strawberries, and whipped cream." And then he left. And about 15 minutes later, he came back from the kitchen with a plate of scrambled eggs and bacon. And he showed it to her, and she just rolled her eyes. She said, "I knew you should have written a note. You probably don't even realize what you've done. But you went in there and you came out with this and you completely forgot my toast. I asked for toast and you didn't have any." So memory can be tricky sometimes. And one of the things that we do to try to remember things that are important to us is we have short sayings, kind of aphorisms, words to live by, words of advice. You probably had some of those growing up around your house. Just some sayings, things that your parents said. And likely there were things their parents said to them, maybe family sayings that get handed down, but they're words of wisdom. Sometimes it can be something very practical about dealing with something around the house or how you're working out in the yard. Sometimes it can be life advice. And so a few days ago, I posted on our Facebook group just to see what kinds of words of wisdom that came to your mind, and several of you shared some of these, and I'll read some of them, and chances are, when I'm reading this list, you're going to hear some things that sound familiar. And it may not be word for word a phrase that you heard growing up, but it could be pretty close to it. So here are some of the things that were shared. If you're green, you're growing. If you're ripe, you're rotting. Work to live, don't live to work. As you are now, so once was I. As I am now, soon you will be. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. I was thinking about fear and sometimes how we're challenged to worry. You can't live your life like that. Pretty is as pretty does. A burden shared is half the burden. A blessing shared is twice the blessing. You're always right up until you were wrong. Be true to your upbringing. In matters of doctrine, unity. In matters of opinion, liberty. In all things, love. I like that. Remember whose you are. Plow to the end of the row. Now, that's not just farming advice. That's life advice tucked away in there. Plow to the end of the row. Treat everyone as you want to be treated. One poem that was up in the house, "Life's full of little sunbeams you'll find scattered far and wide. If you'll only remember to look on the sunny side." Work hard, do things right, and good things will happen. A job worth doing is worth doing right. And then one of them that you'll remember, if you remember the phrase that Mary Margaret Lovell used to love sharing, "There is no limit to what can be accomplished if your only concern is that God gets the credit." Act right and travel light. You can learn more by listening than you can by talking. What goes around comes around. Straighten up and fly right. Chances are, if you listen to that list, you probably heard some of those phrases more than once in your life or something similar to them. And sometimes in different regions, they'll be different. There might be a saying in the South that you go up north, and that's not something that's really popular, but down here you hear it said all the time. Well, it's interesting as we go through this chapter in Mark chapter 2, Jesus is going to use several sayings. Some of them we have historical evidence were sayings before Jesus said them. In other words, he's quoting a proverb that already existed, but he's applying it to a specific situation. And then some of it, you see Jesus taking a very common element and saying, just consider this, and he's infusing it with new meaning because he's talking about ministry. So if you haven't already, I'd invite you to turn to Mark chapter 2. We began last week a series through Mark we're calling Deeper Discipleship. We won't be able to cover every verse of Mark's gospel, but what we've tried to do is go through, and we're going to focus on places in Mark that we haven't spent time on in sermons over the last couple of years, try to find some areas that we haven't dwelt on, but also to think about how this causes us to grow in the way we follow Jesus. And I appreciate so much the songs that we've sung this morning that have focused on what it means to follow him, to follow in his steps. So as we work through this passage that Luke read for us, we're going to start in verse 14, and there are three specific sayings that I want us to zoom in on and think not only about what they meant to them in the first century, we need to understand that, but what do they mean to us? So let's start in verse 14. Notice we see Jesus encountering Levi. We'd also know him as Matthew in the Gospels. And so he's sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." Now, we've already seen Jesus do that last week in chapter 1 when he calls the apostles, the fishermen that are there, Peter, Andrew, James, and John. Now he's calling an unlikely person, a tax collector. And it happened, verse 15, he was reclining at the table in his house, meaning Jesus was eating with him. And many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples. Let's keep reading. "For there were many of them, and they were following him. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, 'Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?'" And then in verse 17 is when we get this first phrase, this first statement I want us to think about. "And hearing this, Jesus said to them, 'It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners.'" Okay, so there's saying number one, statement number one. It's not those who are healthy you need a doctor, but those who are sick. But then verse 18, we find out there's something else they have an issue with. John's disciples, John the Baptist's disciples, and the Pharisees fasted. But apparently Jesus and his followers didn't. And so they come to him and question that. And notice what happens in verse 19. When Jesus says to them, "While the groom, as we would think of it today, is with them, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot fast, can they? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast." So here's statement number two. When they ask Jesus, why aren't your disciples fasting? He says, they can't fast when the groom is with them. You don't have a wedding ceremony that is a time of fasting or grief when the groom is right there with the bride. This is a time of rejoicing. But then he uses another phrase that helps us even build on this. When he says in verse 21, "No one sews a path of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the patch pulls away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear results. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is lost in the skins as well. But one puts new wine into fresh wineskins." Here's that third statement, that third kind of proverb or piece of wisdom that Jesus gives. You don't put an old garment sewn together with a new piece of a garment. You put new wine into new wineskins. There's something new that's needed here. So let's walk through these statements and see what they have to tell us. These are words of wisdom. They're practical pieces of advice that we know are true, but they also remind us of something else. When Jesus is talking about who he spends time with, he shares some words of mission. He says, it's not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I mentioned earlier that we already have a record of this being used. In fact, this is attributed to a lot of different people. One writer, Plutarch, quotes the king of Sparta, who said, "Physicians are not to be found among the weak, but customarily spend their time among the sick." And so that's where you're going to find it, rather the strong, but customarily spend their time around the sick. So that was a common piece of knowledge. And I can remember growing up, the first time we'd go to the pediatrician office, That was the first place I understood you had two different waiting areas. You had the waiting area if you were there for a well visit, and you had the waiting area if you were there because you were sick, and they were on two opposite sides. And I can remember thinking that the side that had the well visits and the well children had cooler toys and books on that side. That's where I wanted to be. So I didn't like going over to this side. But you had to categorize yourself when you walked in. You had to make that distinction. All right, where do I belong? Well, what we find out in the Gospels is the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, were very good at categorizing people. They're very good at putting people where they need to be. What they seem to have a hard time with is diagnosing themselves. That seems to be a little bit harder for them. And so we're introduced to Levi, to Matthew. He's there in Capernaum, sitting at a tax collector's booth. Capernaum has a location that would have made it a prime place for taxes to be collected. It's right on a major trade route, the Via Maris, and so it runs through the city. And so there would have been a lot of taxes collected there, taxes collected for Herod Antipas at the time. Now, this is a Roman leader that is over this area. So not only are you going to have to pay taxes, and we normally don't like paying taxes anyway, just the concept of it, but you're having to pay it to an occupying force. And it may be that you had lived there longer than that force had occupied it, that your family used to not have to pay for this. You used to not have to pay taxes, but now our family does. And so you're paying to people like Matthew. And we don't know a lot about how he got that position. It may have been that was the only position available to him. But we know what people thought about tax collectors. That's pretty clear historically. There are some Jewish traditions that said a Jewish home would be unclean if a tax collector entered it, or put tax collectors in a category of murderers and robbers. And before we think that's really unfair, at least the robbers' description, we need to understand what could often happen with tax collectors. They were required to collect taxes and turn them into Rome, but often they would ask for more than they really needed. And they could keep off the top any of those profits. And so again, we don't get insight into whether or not Matthew was doing that, at least not in the text. We do know another tax collector we read about in the New Testament, Zacchaeus. After he spends time with Jesus, he decides he's going to pay back those that he has taken advantage of. And so it says, if I have cheated anyone, I'll pay them back four times what I've taken. That seems to indicate he knew he had been cheating people. Matthew has a home. He's got a place where he's gathered people. Maybe that's evidence that at some point he did that. We don't know. But we know that if you are in that category, it didn't matter whether you were being honest or not. You would be treated like you were a sinner. And the Pharisees were very good at diagnosing when you walk in the door which side you belong to. And so they just can't believe that Jesus would be spending time with people that they had categorized and classified as sinners. And they've put into this group. Now, some of them we can see were. In fact, Jesus reaches out to individuals who were living lives of sin, but there's a key difference in what Jesus does. He doesn't reach out to individuals who are living in sin to affirm what they were doing and say, keep doing it. He reaches out in order to change their lives, to redeem them. But he can't do that, or he chooses not to do that, without getting to know them, without spending time with them, reaching out to those that were in the margins of society. And so the Pharisees are looking at this and they're wondering, why would Jesus even spend time around those people? And why would Matthew invite all of these sinners to spend time with Jesus? If he's going to change his life and follow this teaching, why is he going to continue spending time around these people? But it's interesting, if you think about it, who did Matthew know? Who was he friends with? Who were his people? These were the people he worked with. These were the people he knew, and he was bringing them to Jesus. There are times when someone becomes a Christian, when that person, right after becoming a Christian, has more contacts to reach with the message of Jesus than you or I would. They have more friendships. They have more people that they've known that they can bring to Christ. You know, when you've been a Christian for a little while, it's easy to spend time just around other Christians and to not have those relationships cultivated with people that you can share the gospel with. So Matthew is simply bringing the people he knows to eat together. And Jesus says, those are the people that I'm here for. That was his mission. So how does that impact the way I see the world around me? Because I don't know about you, it's really easy for me to look at the Pharisees and to be negative about the way they categorized people. But I have to challenge myself and think about the way I categorize individuals and where I need to spend my time. It could be that you look at one hand and you say, well, the Pharisees had a point, didn't they? I mean, do I want to spend time with people who were doing things that I know they shouldn't do? Here I think Jesus' example gives us that clear distinction. It's not spending time around others to affirm what they're doing. When Jesus was spending time around them, he was reaching them. He was loving them. He was sharing a new way of living with them. And if I'm not willing to do that, I'm not going to be able to reflect the mission of Jesus. Jesus said he was looking for those who were sick to share the message of the great physician. If I'm going to share his message, I've got to do the same thing. I have to intentionally spend time with people who are different from me and who I might be tempted to put in another category. And we often have the tendency to write people off even for things that maybe don't even matter as much. You know, if someone has a different opinion than I do about something that matters to me, I might put them in a category over here. Say, well, that's a hopeless case right there. You know, they don't agree with me on this. How would they ever want to talk with me about Jesus? How would they ever want to look at the Bible? They can't believe it. I'll just put them over here. They said something. They posted something. They did something that I didn't agree with. So they're over here in this category. But Jesus says, anyone who is sick needs a physician. Or maybe I just kind of categorize someone based on their past. You know what this person did? You know, I grew up with this person. You know what this person used to do? You know what she used to say? You know how he used to live? So I'm going to put him in this category. And they'll stay over there. I'm not really going to associate myself with them. Jesus says it's not the healthy who need a physician. What would change if I started to view everyone around me through these words of mission? It's also interesting to think about the Pharisees' tendency to categorize others and the struggle to categorize themselves. It's hard for us to see ourselves clearly. You ever noticed that? You ever heard yourself speak on a recording or in a video or seen yourself and you thought, I don't look like that, do I? That's not the way I really look. That's not the way I really sound. It's hard for us to see ourselves accurately. We could be making the same mistake they did. And so instead of categorizing individuals and saying, okay, well, this group is outcast, I'm not going to associate with them, we would do well to remember these words of mission. Who is it that needs a doctor? But then secondly, as he describes this issue about fasting, he gives them some words of identity. Words of understanding who he is. Notice what takes place when he says, they're complaining about fasting. He says, the groom is with them. When the groom's with them, the attendants of the bridegroom can't fast. Now, we know from history and from what we see other places in Scripture that even though the Old Testament only required fasting on the Day of Atonement, by the time Jesus is walking the earth, it was a common practice weekly, at least twice a week, for many Jews to fast. Jesus talks about this in the Sermon on the Mount when he points out some of the people who were fasting to be seen by other individuals. And so it was a practice that was associated with prayer. It was associated with personal piety and with religious growth. And so it wasn't a diet or kind of a health fad. This was something where you took the time you would normally spend in eating or even going and getting food for yourself, and you dedicated that to God. But for some reason, they noticed that John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, but Jesus' apostles weren't. What was the difference? And so Jesus uses this illustration of great joy. If you're together at a wedding, there's a feast set out. And in Jesus' time, weddings would last for days. The feast would be continual. That's a time of joy. He's trying to help them understand, you have to know who I am. When I am with these people, when the groom is with the wedding party, they're not going to fast. They're going to rejoice. In fact, there are other passages. Just listen to some of these ways that Jesus is described as the groom in some of these New Testament passages. John the Baptist himself would describe his mission and Jesus' mission. He would say, "He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom," that's John, "who stands and hears him, rejoices fully because of the bridegroom's voice. So this joy of mine has been made full." So John is saying, here, the groom is here, and I'm not going to compete with him because I know he's the one that I'm excited about. My joy is made full because of him. Or when Paul would write to the church at Corinth, and he would describe Christians there, he would say they're betrothed, the church is betrothed to one husband, thinking about Jesus and the church as the bride of Christ. Or even in Revelation 21, when the New Jerusalem, the holy city, is described, it's coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And so when Jesus uses this statement, when he says that he is the bridegroom, he's saying something very significant about who he is. And that's important because there are a lot of individuals you might read or you might hear that say, you know, Jesus never really claimed to be the Messiah. He didn't claim to be the Son of God. That came later. Christians came later, and they sort of read into some of what Jesus said, and they kind of stretched some things, and some would even say Jesus would be shocked to hear that people said he was the Messiah. Well, you have a hard time with passages like Mark 2, where Jesus is saying, "I am the bridegroom, I am here." Why are they not fasting? They're not fasting because the Son of God is here. There's a time for rejoicing. He said, "I'm not going to be here forever physically with him. And when I'm no longer here, then there can be a time for fasting, but not right now." And so their whole viewpoint of how they viewed life around them changed based on Jesus' identity. So here's a question for us, using this wise statement. Do I understand how my life should be different when I'm with Jesus? Do I understand what should be different about the way I act and the way I live when I know that he is with me? It was different for Jesus' disciples. They were living differently because they knew who their teacher, they knew they were with their teacher. They didn't understand everything about who Jesus was and what his mission was. We know that. But they understood that they were with him. And because of that, Jesus says, they're going to be different. So from my vantage point, as someone who has the blessing of the New Testament and understanding who Jesus is, how can my attitude be different when I am with Jesus? If people look at me and they see me acting the same way that they see anyone else acting, are they going to be able to learn anything distinctive about who Jesus is? If I don't seem like there's anything in my life that's helping me through challenges, that's comforting me in grief, that's helping me navigate times of fear and uncertainty, if people look to me and they don't see anything different, are they going to be able to see Jesus' identity? There should be something different about my life. And in fact, I'm not going to be able to fully understand my own identity until I understand his. Later on in Mark, there's going to be these series of times where Jesus will describe to his apostles what's going to happen, that he's going to be betrayed, that he's going to be put to death, that he's going to rise on the third day. They're going to be resistant to that. Peter and others will say, that's not going to happen. And then you'll see very closely connected with that a misunderstanding of their own mission, where they're competing over who's going to be the best or who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. I can't understand my mission until I understand Jesus' mission. I can't understand my identity until I understand his. I can't be a Christian without knowing I live differently because I'm with him. But he goes on to build on that point. It's not just about his identity, but then he uses this language about garments, pieces of garments being sewed together in wineskins, things that seem different and foreign to us, that's not a part of our daily life. But what he's really sharing is words of perspective that will change their entire viewpoint. He says, no one sews a path of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. And so as you can imagine, especially in the ancient world, you would need leather wineskins that would be soft and flexible when they were new, but over time, they'd become dry and brittle. And so if you have new wine that's unfermented, but as it expands while it's fermenting, it produces cracks in this dry skin, then you wouldn't want to put new wine in an old wineskin. It would burst. Jesus is saying, you need to understand the elements that you're dealing with. If you have new wine, you put it into new wineskins. You don't take a path of unshrunk cloth onto an old garment. You understand what you're matching with what else. There's a different perspective that's here. Jesus has come, and he has something new to share. It's not putting away the old covenant in the sense that it's destroying it, saying it's not important. It's fulfilling it, but it's new. In fact, one of the things that shows up in Jesus' teaching in Mark and in the other Gospels is he's teaching with authority. Why is Jesus teaching with authority? He's the Son of God. He's got something new to say. And so the former way they were thinking, the way they were viewing life where, well, yes, we do need to fast because we don't have the Messiah here. He's saying there's something new. There's something different. And in order to understand Jesus, we're going to have to change our perspective. And you know, that's a constant struggle we see in Scripture. Because even once the church is established, there are Christians in Galatia who are trying to put this new wine into old wineskins, that are trying to put things together that don't match up. And so they want to take Jesus, they want to take his teaching with authority, but they also want to match it up with some of these elements of the old covenant that make them feel comfortable, that remind them of their childhood, that remind them of the way they used to live when they were living under the law of Moses. But Paul is very clear. If you start mixing those things together, it's not the gospel at all. You're putting new wine into old wineskins. It's not going to work. You fast forward to the 21st century. We might not have the same tendency the churches in Galatia did, but don't we have that same temptation to try to add something else to Jesus' message? Maybe to mix in with teachings in Scripture things that we think are important. And we're reminded, no, he's the one teaching with authority. This new wineskin idea means I need to take Jesus' teaching and align my actions with his covenant. Do only what he commands. If he's teaching with authority in the New Testament, that means his is going to be different. I want to be a part of that covenant. And that means it's going to be different than the culture around me. And if I try to add in elements of the culture that exists around and try to let that shape my actions in and sort of mix that together with the commands of Jesus, it's going to burst. That's new wine, and you're trying to use old wineskins. You're trying to use the wrong container. If I try to take, well, this is a tradition that I always thought was important, and yeah, it's not exactly in Scripture, but I think it's just as important as Scripture. And I'm going to sew those things together. Jesus is saying that's going to pull apart. He's the one with authority. My perspective on life has to be formed by him. He shared with them words of his mission. He was there for those who needed help. He was there for the sick. He shares words of identity. He is the Messiah. Life's going to be different when I know Jesus. And words of perspective. I need to look at life the way he would call me to look at life. We began by thinking about words of wisdom that are important to us. They help us remember things that matter. And as we think about those sayings and those lists, as a friend of mine said, he had certain sayings when he was growing up. He said, well, I live or die by these. You know, these are important statements. It's good for us to think about those words of wisdom that we're passing on. But it's even more important for us to reflect on these words of wisdom. Am I passing on an understanding of my mission as a Christian? Am I passing on words of wisdom about my identity as a child of God, as someone who's walking with Jesus? Am I passing on words of perspective that will help my children and their children understand God's mission for Christians in the world today? The good news of Scripture is, as long as we have time, it's never too late to respond to those words of wisdom and to begin sharing them in the lives of those around us. If you're here this morning and you need to become a child of God, you've categorized yourself and realized you're one of those that Jesus came to reach. You're one who needs spiritual help. And you need to turn your life around to put Christ on in baptism. We would love to celebrate that with you. It may be there's another need that you have in your life. If you'd like to, right after this worship service, through this doorway, there is a conference room where a couple of our shepherds would love to sit down with you and to talk with you, pray with you, get to know you better. But it may be that you'd like the prayers of this congregation. as we reflect on words of wisdom, the wisest thing we can do today is to make sure we leave here determined to live for God. If there's any way we can help you, please come as we stand and as we sing together.